This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
Some staying with destitute host families, but most sleeping in the open, under the trees, or in makeshift shelters, or on the dirt floors of schools. Others were in abandoned villages whose residents had fled Boko Haram attacks earlier. A number of families were separated while crossing into Cameroon.
That's UNHCR spokesman Leo Dobbs talking about the dire living conditions of refugees in the border area in northern Cameroon. Details coming up. Also, the official 16-day campaign against gender violence, which mainly targets women and girls, starts today. And in Ghana, voters go to the polls on December 7th to elect members of parliament and a new president. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the International Organization for Migration reports that an estimated 1,300 refugees and migrants have been rescued from rough Mediterranean waters in the last 3 days. 8 aboard those vessels bound for Italy drowned. Migrant traffic at sea is down this year, with only 168,000 migrants entering Italy and Greece. The numbers were 4 times higher in 2015. But this year's deaths are more than 1,000 higher than the previous year's total of 3,500. Most of those recent deaths have occurred in the central Mediterranean as migrants sailed from Libyan shores to the Italian coast. That may change as Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan today threatens to break an agreement with the European Union to freeze migrations from the Middle East to Greece. In other refugee news, the UNHCR reports that thousands of Nigerian refugees massed along a remote border area in northern Cameroon are living in dire conditions with little in the way of shelter and basic necessities. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Prevailing insecurity makes Cameroon's isolated far north region generally out of bounds for aid workers, but a rare break in the threatening environment made it possible for staff from the UN Refugee Agency to go there earlier this month and assess the situation. UNHCR spokesman Leo Dobbs tells VOA the refugees, mostly women and children, are living in abysmal conditions and remain under threat of attack by Boko Haram militants.
Some staying with destitute host families, but most sleeping in the open, under the trees, or in makeshift shelters, or on the dirt floors of schools. Others were in abandoned villages whose residents had fled Boko Haram attacks earlier. A number of families were separated while crossing into Cameroon.
Dobbs says the refugees are almost entirely dependent on the local community, which is itself poor. He says people lack health care and sanitation, safe drinking water, and other basic services. UNHCR wants the refugees to move to a safe camp nearby.
We're encouraging people to come away from those isolated regions in the north and near the border and to go to the Menawau camp, which is further, about 60 kilometers to the south, and where there are currently 60,000 refugees, and they're getting the care they need, the security.
While the UNHCR aid workers were in the area, they registered more than 21,000 refugees who have been living for months with host families after fleeing deadly Boko Haram attacks in northeast Nigeria. A survey carried out in October by the International Organization for Migration estimated the number of refugees at around 27,000. But Dobbs says the actual number is probably much higher. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Nigeria's Kaduna State, on a Saturday, a cattle herder and a farmer quarreled over a piece of land. The next day, the cattleman shot and killed the farmer. Days later, 34 died in reprisal shootings. 150 houses were burned to the ground. No arrests were made. The herdsmen are Fulani, who often move their livestock across national boundaries. There are now reports their paths cross with Boko Haram militants, who cross borders as well. Reporter Isaac Abrak in Abuja talked to VOA's David Arnold about the Fulani and possible links to the Islamist terrorists.
When these Fulani people attack, they basically run off into the bush. And to be fair, honestly, of all these attacks, I cannot remember of any. But I think the number of arrests of the perpetrators of these acts, which are always allegedly said to be the Fulanis, but I know that recently President Muhammadu Buhari issued a directive that any Fulani headsman that is found with a weapon should be arrested.
Is that going to be an effective reduction in the violence?
If it is enforced, yes, it's possible. But honestly, the violence between the Fulani and the farmers, it's a very delicate issue. I think it goes beyond just issuing a directive that they should be arrested.
Have they tried to negotiate grazing lands for the Fulanis?
Recently, because of the spike in this attack, it was proposed that various governments at state level and federal level proposed that grazing reserves were going to be located across the state in Nigeria. A lot of these farmers are really against this, especially in Kaduna State. A lot of the farmers from the southern part of Christian farmers have really kicked against this.
Just in Kaduna State, do you find that many of the farmers are willing to allow grazing reserves to reduce the conflict?
The farmers have not accepted it. Most of the communities across the state will not accept grazing reserves in their community.
How can the government resolve these crises?
I think the bill is still in the National Assembly and it has not gone anywhere. I think that bill has even been silent at the moment. We've had state governors that have come out to declare that they will not accept that in their state. I don't see the possibility of the government pushing through this bill and bringing it into law. Everybody knows that the headsmen that we knew back here 10, 15 years ago don't have AK-47, don't carry AK-47. They only carry sticks. I have a personal experience of that. There is the suspicion that there is a spillover effect of Boko Haram into this Fulani assault on the farmers.
What do you think is the link between the Fulani and Boko Haram?
Most of the Fulani people, some of them, they come from the countries where Boko Haram operates from, like Chad, Niger, Cameroon. Nomadic Fulanis come to all these regions. It has been reported that initially the Fulani headmen helped Boko Haram to move weapons across the border. What they would normally just do is they go back and help supply weapons. In most times, it is the nomadic Fulani that are caught in this violence with the farmers. This is basically as a result of the Fulani men are moving around due to climate change. The regions which stay, particularly the northeast and the northwest, no longer have enough green vegetation. So they come down towards north-central Nigeria, where there is green vegetation. At this time, they have clashes with the farmers.
That was reporter Isaac Abrak in Abuja talking to VOA's David Arnold about the Fulani cattlemen. In Zimbabwe, as in other countries, today marks the start of an official 16-day campaign against gender violence targeting women and girls. Activists in Zimbabwe are concentrating on early marriage, a practice that remains popular despite this year's Constitutional Court declaration that it is against the law. Sebastian Mumfu has more from Harare.
Official statistics released this week say about 5,000 Zimbabwean children have left school this year alone because of early marriages, something that worries officials, UN agencies, and activists who want children to complete their education. On Friday, Zivai Makanda from the local NGO Zimbabwe Girls Legacy said the figures have made the organization change focus.
We are specializing on the topic what stresses girls out so that we manage and see what's the root of early child marriages. So the girls raise issues like poverty, culture, and some of the issues like fights, and abuse within their families. Issues like having a stepmother or a stepfather. So that's some of the things which girls will be running away from.
Zimbabwe Girls Legacy is one of the groups that met Friday with the government officials and international organizations to discuss ways of ending child marriage, which continues despite a ruling from Zimbabwe's Constitutional Court that it is illegal to marry anyone under the age of 18. Kumbirai Kahia, the founder and director of the Girls and Women Empowerment Network of Zimbabwe, says laws alone mean nothing.
Because in our culture, if a girl falls pregnant, we expect her to get married. We are happy that the Constitutional Court has already set 18 years as the minimum age of marriage. So we want to continue to ensure that the laws that we have are not just mentioned, are not just passed, but they are implemented. So the government needs to continue to engage civil society organizations as well as other people in the community, not to force child marriages.
Zimbabwe is one of the four Southern African countries with the highest rates of girl-child marriages, according to the United Nations Population Fund and the Development Group Plan International. The others are Malawi, Mozambique, and Zambia. Poverty, religion, and tradition are the main reason for child marriages in Zimbabwe, where more than one-third of girls are wed before they turn 18. The United Nations Population Fund calls child marriage a violation of human rights. By all indications, however, few Zimbabweans share that view. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. And at 17 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. According to a UN report, thousands of Nigerian refugees massed along a remote border area in northern Cameroon are living in dire conditions. And the official 16-day campaign against gender violence, which mainly targets women and girls, starts today. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. In Ghana, voters go to the polls on December 7th to elect members of parliament and a new president. Seven candidates are vying for the presidency. The top contenders are the sitting president, John Dramani Mahama, of the National Democratic Congress, NDC, and Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo of the New Patriotic Party, NPP. Mahama is seeking another four-year term, while Akufo-Addo is making a third bid for the presidency. From Accra, reporter Joanna Manti spoke to Kojo Apapuni Asante, a director of the think tank Ghana Center for Democratic Development. She asked him about possible issues that voters may consider before casting their ballots on December 7th.
We've done two pre-election surveys. There were about three main issues that our respondents said they wanted. One was unemployment. Then there was also issues to do with the management of the economy. Education is also on the list.
And where do opponents see that the government has failed or succeeded?
The main opposition party has emphasized the management of the economy as one of the weaknesses of the government. Corruption as another issue that they have raised, and basically consider the problems with the economy as a result of lack of competence of the ruling regime.
And what is the government in power saying? Because I'm sure they will want to be retained in power.
Right. So the message from the ruling government has been that they have done a lot in terms of infrastructure, in terms of building roads, school buildings, and so on and so forth. And they feel that they have created a foundation for more development projects, and therefore they should be retained.
But is there any reason why Ghana's neighbors should be interested in the elections in Ghana?
Ghana has always been sort of the standard bearer for elections, but also in terms of its own development trajectory. So every time that Ghana goes to elections, everybody, not just in the sub-region, but you know, across Africa, everybody is trying to see whether or not Ghana will pass another test of peaceful, credible elections, because that's always the litmus test for every other African nation who is going into elections, that they perform like Ghana. So I think there's always an interest. The other thing for our closer neighbors is that there are always concerns about foreigners voting. So whether you are in the Cote d'Ivoire border, in the western part of Ghana, there's always concerns there. If you are in the eastern part, in the Togo border, questions are raised. And in the northern part, in Burkina Faso. So there are always concerns that those countries should make sure that citizens don't cross the border to come and vote.
Is there usually violence in Ghana's elections?
There are very few sort of sporadic violence, but nothing that escalates to the level where we saw maybe, say, in Cote d'Ivoire or in the Kenya elections.
But considering the survey that you conducted, do we have to worry over violence in this year's elections?
Yeah, I think everybody acknowledges that these elections, they are much higher stakes because the opposition is going to contest this election for the third time. The candidate is the same person. So people feel this is the last chance. The same with the government that is trying to stay in power. So the stakes are high, but there are also already signs that people are going to be less accommodating of each other come this election. So there's already concerns from our pre-election survey. People express concerns about violence breaking out, and therefore people should do a lot more education and encourage, you know, peaceful elections.
Generally, how would you describe women's participation in this year's election?
I think we've been tracking some of that in terms of how many women appear on campaign platforms, how many parliamentary candidates are standing that are women. The numbers are encouraging. So it will be interesting to see whether the prospects are better this time round than it has been in the past.
That was Kojo Opopuni Asante of the Ghana Center for Democratic Development. He was speaking with reporter Joanna Manti. Burundi's human rights minister has told journalists his government refuses to cooperate with a UN inquiry into months of national political violence. Martin Nvibandi said Thursday the accusations of government abuses were part of a political plot. The UN released a September report by a panel of independent experts identifying some government officials suspected of ordering political opposition to be tortured or killed. In reply, the government banned the three experts from Burundi. Nvibandi said some international organizations want to destabilize some governments in Africa. In April, the International Criminal Court said political violence has led to the deaths of 450 people and forced hundreds of thousands to flee. The yearly gathering in The Hague of member states of the International Criminal Court ended this week. A major topic at the meeting was the announcement by three African countries, South Africa, Burundi, and Gambia, that they plan to withdraw. From the Dutch city of The Hague, Stefan van den Berg reports.
Those states intending to leave stated their reasons at a special session of the assembly that was closed to the media. Alpha Cissé, who followed the debate as a representative of the NGO Open Society Justice Initiative, says those that planned to withdraw gave a variety of justifications.
Well, so there were different reasons being given. I mean, some very legal, some very political, and the legal issues have had political reactions as well.
The withdrawal by South Africa centers around a row over the country's failure to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir last year when he was in Johannesburg for an African Union summit. Pretoria wants the ICC to accept diplomatic immunity for sitting heads of state so South Africa can facilitate peace negotiations on the continent.
They have argued, and which is what they said, that remaining as part of the Rome Statute system puts them in conflict with other obligations that they have on the continent, and that is their reason for withdrawing. I mean, Burundi has a very different reason. I mean, Burundi is a subject of preliminary examination by the Office of the Prosecutor of the ICC, and they basically have problems with the way preliminary examination has been conducted. So they're withdrawing for that purpose. The Gambia, it's very unclear. I think it's been part of the general complaints that the ICC not being accountable. I mean, the ICC having a bias against Africa, etc., etc.
The court, and especially Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, who is from The Gambia, says the court is not biased.
This criticism lacks validity. It's not valid. It's also not backed by the facts, the relevant facts, which is that it is African states that are coming to the court, that are asking the court to intervene. And in all the situations that we have in Africa, which is 8 situations, 5 out of those situations were at the request of African states. And that's what the court is meant to do. If states parties are not able to investigate and prosecute these atrocity crimes, being part of the court, they can request the court to intervene. The other two is Libya and Sudan. Those ones also were at the request of the UN Security Council.
But the fact that all of the courts accused so far have been African has not sat well with many African member states of the ICC. The representative of the African Union, Adewale Iyande, says it is a systemic problem.
Look, it probably is a systemic issue. As I indicated, the way the ICC is currently structured probably would lead to more situations and more cases coming out of the African continent than you would have in other parts of the world, and particularly as it affects more powerful interests, right?
Despite the criticism, many African states spoke out in support of the court. Sierra Leone's ambassador to Brussels, Ibrahim Sori, sees a clear way out of this crisis.
It's a dialogue. It's a dialogue. We continue dialogue and to let reason prevail that it is in our interest, in the interest of Africa, to stay behind and lead the process as we had done during the time when the court was being established. Africa played a frontline role. We should not be seen to be moving away from it because of challenges. The challenges are meant to be solved.
The state's parties at this ICC assembly all stress the need for a dialogue about the concerns of many African members. However, observers note that no concrete steps have been taken as yet to set up such talks. The coming year will show if the court can reverse the trend of withdrawals. From The Hague, I'm Stephanie Vandenberg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover.
You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.